Himself in a world of trouble. Queen Jezebel sent word to him that she's about to lower the boom. Matter of fact, Jezebel's taken a solemn oath to relieve both Elijah and the world of his meddling self. After hearing this, Elijah goes on the lam, hoping against hope that he can outrun the troubles that pursue him. But his troubles are as relentless as he is desperate. And finally, tired of the chase, he goes by himself out into the wilderness and prays, "Lord, I've run about as far as I can run. I've endured as much as I'm likely to endure. As far as I'm concerned, the race is finished. Please, if you have any mercy, bring me home. And if home is not a place I'm worthy of coming, then at least get me out of here." Alone in the wasteland, Elijah lays down beneath the broom tree and prepares to die. Now, if you want to understand how it is that Elijah has come to this sad state, we need to take just a moment to see where the story has come. Well, back at the end of chapter 16, we get a short synopsis of the way things are going for the northern kingdom of Israel. Ahab, the son of Omri, has become king, and he marries a Gentile woman whose name is Jezebel. Yeah, Jezebel, that's where we get that from, right? Jezebel worships fertility gods, Baal and Asherah, which infuriates the God of Israel. As a consequence, Elijah arrives on the scene with a word from the Lord about the ramifications of Ahab's poor decision to open up Israel to the worship of other gods. "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years except by my word." God shuts up the heavens against Israel, and Elijah is the bearer of bad tidings. After 3 years of drought, God comes to Elijah and says, "Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." Clearly, Elijah's not been the toast of the town. In fact, Ahab has been trying to hunt him down for about 3 years now. So when Elijah finally shows up on Ahab's doorstep, the first thing he says is, "Aha, you troubler of Israel." And Elijah replies, "I've not troubled Israel. You have. Your father's house. Because you've forsaken the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." Idols. Now, it's just this impertinence that leads to the really well-worn story from Sunday school about the contest to bring down fire from heaven. You remember that one? Elijah challenges the 450 prophets of Baal to lay a bull on the altar. And on top of Mount Carmel, they pray to their God, imploring their God to speak. And he doesn't. So Elijah mocks them. You remember this? "Maybe he's asleep. Maybe he's gone for a walk. Call him again. Maybe he just hasn't checked his voicemail." And on, he chides them. All of this goes on for the better part of a day until Elijah finally tells the people to lay a bull on the altar of the Lord and to wet it down stand back. He prays, and fire comes down out of heaven, consuming the burnt offering, consuming the wood, consuming the stones and the dust. Now, this being apparently proof enough, Elijah has all of the false prophets put to death. And then he tells Ahab, now it's going to rain. All right, but see, here's the problem. You know, those prophets, those 450 prophets of Baal, they didn't belong to Ahab. They belonged to Ahab's wife, Jezebel. And apparently she wasn't in on the decision to have them rubbed out. Accordingly, and suffice it to say, she's more than just a little annoyed with Elijah. So he heads for the hills, and she sends a messenger to tell him that she's going to make his life, as Thomas Hobbes said, nasty, brutish, and short. Which is how Elijah comes to find himself under the broom tree, contemplating an early retirement. Now, one question that arises for me upon reading this story is a fairly obvious one. I mean, how does a person get to the point where even being wiped from the face of the earth looks preferable to spending another day in it? Have you ever been that far down? Ever just wander out into the wilderness, sit down under the broom tree, and wait to die? Phone rings, you get up from the floor, you've been playing Chinese checkers with the grandkids, you don't want to answer the phone, but you know you can't take another night of not knowing. Your palms are slippery against the hard plastic as the voice on the other end of the line says, "We've gotten back the results of your biopsy." And what did they say? We'd really rather talk to you about this in the office. Can you come in tomorrow? And there it is. You hang up and you call your son to come pick up your grandkids. And you sit down in the living room beneath the broom tree. The car, it pulls finally into the driveway. Your spouse, whom you haven't seen for days, at least it seems like that, she steps out of the car, walks up the sidewalk, and you knew it was bad. I mean, even if you had successfully avoided admitting it to yourself, you knew it was bad. I mean, there weren't that many fights anymore, just a lot of nothing, a lot of silence. But the last fight you had felt big. And the front door opens. And you see the face you've seen walk through that door 1,000 times before. You weren't expecting flowers, but you sure didn't think you'd get this. Honey, I've been doing some thinking, and this just isn't working. I think we need to spend some time apart. And what do? You exhale. And you lie down in the lazy boy in the shadow of the broom tree. Or how about this? You're finishing up just that last bit of work before taking off for the weekend. Your secretary calls you and says the words that no parent ever wants to hear. The police are on line one for you. 1,000 things race through your mind as you reach to punch the button marked line one, and strangely enough, none of them are good. What now? What could it possibly be? We've tried so hard. Hello? Yes, hello, this is Officer Jefferson, and I'm sorry to be the one to have to tell you this, but there's been an accident. And your head falls onto your desk, and you look, and out of the corner of your eye, you see a broom tree planted outside the office next to the rhododendron. Have you ever felt like that? Just like you wanted to curl up and cease to exist? I suspect that the fear in the pit of Elijah's stomach is a dread and anxiety known to many of us. Elijah goes to God in the wilderness and says, "Look, I've done the best I know to do. What now? I can't do this anymore." Elijah goes to God seeking, well, if not a redress of his grievances, then at least a way out. Look, if you're not going to get rid of Ahab and Jezebel, then at least do me the service of not keeping me around to see what they're going to do to me when they find me. Ever feel that way? That God can't fix my world, then at least take me out of it, someplace else. If you can't take away the source of my anxiety and pain, then at least take me away from it. Let me escape. Let me go. I don't think I can do it anymore. I don't have either the energy or the stamina, maybe even the faith, to stand it any longer. Or as Elijah puts it, it is enough. It is enough. And his cry is all the more poignant and real because we've heard that cry before, sometimes escaping from our own lips. But how does Elijah answer, or how is his prayer answered by God? What is it that God does in the face of Elijah's, I think, righteous complaint? What does God do? Not a whole lot. Elijah wants no longer to have to deal with Ahab and Jezebel, but not only are they still out there, they're seeking his life with all the same vengeance with which they've sought it before. All right, then, if God can't take care of Ahab and Jezebel, then at least take care of Elijah by taking him home. Taking him any place other than the place where every waking moment is filled with the terrifying thoughts of finding himself as the star of his own nightmare. But what does God do? I mean, how does God deal with the very real trauma that Elijah faces? I mean, that's important to point out. This isn't just some sort of imagined psychodrama, right? He's actually got something to be afraid of. And how does God respond? God says, well, I'll tell you what you do. Go out, stand on the mountain before the Lord. The Lord is about to pass by. Now, doesn't that seem strange to you? I mean, here Elijah is all done in, ready to sell the farm, bewildered, desperate, defeated, asking for just a little help, a little relief, and all God can do is say, just go stand over there. I'm coming through. You see, God doesn't do for Elijah what God often doesn't do for us. I mean, God doesn't come generally into our lives and say, all right, I heard it, I'll fix it. God doesn't often come into our lives and say, I'll get you out of it. All God says is, I'll stand by your side. Perhaps when standing is the last thing you think you're capable of. See, the key to understanding these verses is the recognition that they fail to make any visible difference in Elijah's situation. I mean, he's in exactly the same place after his encounter with God as before, complaining in exactly the same words. God's presence doesn't promise that everything is suddenly going to be all better. That's a lie that we've often told. doesn't straighten Jezebel out. I mean, she's still after him. And perhaps just as importantly, God's passing by doesn't even give Elijah a kind of peace and tranquility in the face of things. Elijah goes to God seeking relief, goes to God looking for some kind of remedy for the great weariness he feels in his bones. He wants God to change the world, but all God offers to do is to be there. And perhaps in the process, change him. Presumably, according to the way God looks at the world, being in God's presence is of ultimately greater value to us in our pain and despair than any stopgap measures, any dime store remedies we could conjure up on our own. I mean, it's so easy to want God to fix the world or to take us out of the pain. But what God offers to do for us is to stand with us in it. The situation faced by Elijah, the situation often faced by us, they feel singular and unique, but people experience these things more than just us. Pain, fear, disappointment, abandonment. Those are things that get felt all the time. But what those situations point to is unique. There once was a time when the whole world had played out its hand, when humanity's isolation was real and without hope. And God heard that cry of despair from under the broom tree. And instead of fixing it or even taking humanity out of the world, God came into it. God heard our cry and came to us. A Jewish carpenter nailed to the broom tree in the name of political expediency. That's God's idea of fixing things. See, God's remedy rarely fixes things the way that we would if we were running the show. God's fix of things hardly even looks like a fix at all. And it's rarely the one that we ask for, but the remedy God provides. The remedy God provides is always the one that we need. Amen.